Hi, it's Hugh Hewitt. Welcome to the interview with Hugh Hewitt, sponsored by AndrewandTodd.com. Andrew and Todd are with Sierra Pacific Mortgage. They help you with all your real estate lending needs. If you're refinancing your home, if you're buying a new home, if you're a senior who wants a reverse mortgage, or if you're a veteran who doesn't want to put any money down, whatever it is, if you're in the private real estate market for yourself, and maybe you want an investment property, try AndrewandTodd.com or call 888-888-1172. Now on to the interview with Hugh Hewitt. Morning, Glory America. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway today. Welcome to all of you, wherever you are in the United States, across these 400 affiliates. I have a special guest. Dr. Peter McCullough is my guest this half hour. He's an internist, a cardiologist, an epidemiologist, a professor of medicine at Texas A&M College of Medicine in Dallas, Texas. Since the outset of the pandemic, Dr. McCullough has been a leader in the medical response to COVID-19 disaster. He's published, quote, Pathophysiological Basis and Rationale for Early Outpatient Treatment of SARS-CoV-2, COVID-19 Infection. That's going to confuse the Steelers fan, which is the first synthesis of sequenced multi-rung treatment of ambulatory patients infected with the virus in the American Journal of Medicine, and subsequently updated in reviews in cardiovascular medicine. He has 40 peer-reviewed publications on the infection. He's commented extensively on the medical response to the COVID crisis in The Hill and on Fox News. On November 19th of last year, Dr. McCullough testified in the U.S. Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs, and throughout 2021 in the Texas Senate Committee on Health and Human Services, the Colorado General Assembly, and New Hampshire Senate concerning many aspects of the pandemic response. We now have at SalemNow.com a nearly two-hour conversation with Dr. McCullough about a variety of aspects connected to the pandemic. Dr. McCullough, welcome to the Hugh Hewitt Show. Thank you for making time for me this morning.
Thanks, Hugh. Thanks for having me.
I'm not a doctor. I want to give you my background with the virus. When exposed twice and half of my staff got it, I was prescribed ivermectin by my doctor, and I did not get it. I subsequently got the Pfizer vaccine in the second dose. I've had Dr. Fauci on the show twice. I've had Dr. Collins on three times. I've had skeptics and critics on. I try and cover everything. And if I could, doctor, I want to give a brief summary. Everyone should listen to your entire two-hour interview. But the brief summary I come up with is there was a massive failure by the CDC, the FDA, and the NIH to properly treat early onset of COVID that led to many subsequent deaths. There was an inability to frame the medical issues correctly, you argue, an unprecedented break with past practice. The response that we adopted was colored by fear, primarily rooted in the Ebola experience, and it was made authoritative by the CDC, the NIH, HHS, and the FDA, and the medical establishment, you stress, and the early and consistent push and focus on vaccines will be seen as a huge mistake. You believe, basically, that the American medical establishment adopted something called therapeutic nihilism. Is that a fair summary, doctor?
Yeah, that's a pretty good summary, and it may sound severe to the listeners, but I think everyone would understand that, you know, vaccines are not in a treatment. The vaccine doesn't help an acutely sick patient get better. And for high-risk patients, this is a potentially fatal event. So when Americans are given their COVID-19 positive test result, some of our senior citizens and our patients with multiple medical problems, they go into a complete panic. And it's the first time in medicine that we don't offer them an acute treatment to prevent hospitalization and death. It's a real break from conventional practice.
The term therapeutic nihilism is one that I think will penetrate into the consciousness and become an accepted description of what happened early on, perhaps driven by panic. There is a part of this I want to talk to you about, which is the problem of asymptomatic transmission, which I did not hear you deal with at length in the interview, and I want to talk to you about it. But would you explain what therapeutic nihilism is?
Well, therapeutic nihilism is a term in the medical literature, and it describes when doctors and other healthcare providers decide not to offer treatment. So one of the most common areas where this happens, believe it or not, is end-stage renal disease in patients who are on dialysis. There, it's thought that the dialysis is such an overriding condition that, in fact, we may not do things like, you know, prescribe cholesterol pills or things of this nature. It's almost too end-stage. The same thing is true for cancer. At some point in time, we back off. But with COVID-19, someone acutely ill, my judgment is there's never any reason to back off. I mean, this is an acute infection like anything else. If we start treatment early, that's our best chance of reducing the risk of hospitalization and death.
For about a year, doctor, I have a good friend, David Zbogna, who is a medical device manufacturer and a very successful one, who was telling me that it was simply criminal that we were not treating people aggressively at home using every available, I believe you call it Nutra pharmaceutical bundle, because it was effective, like ivermectin, or couldn't hurt. And I've had Dr. Collins tell me there's absolutely no evidence it could hurt. Hydroxychloroquine had some studies that said it could hurt, but there were other things like zinc, et cetera. If we were doing it over again, do you believe that the medical establishment would adopt early interventions at home using the nutraceutical bundle more aggressively?
I think your listeners should understand that the research suggests deficiencies in things put patients at higher risk, like vitamin D deficiency. And although we can't measure it, we believe zinc deficiency. So the nutraceutical bundle is thought to be good clinical practice and includes zinc, vitamin D, vitamin C, a supplement a lot of people don't know about called quercetin or quercetin. And some may say lysine or N-acetylcysteine. And people may say that's a lot of supplements. But the idea here is that this, for some people, is going to be the most serious infection they ever have. And so why not start out in good shape from a supplement and nutraceutical and micronutrient perspective? Why be behind the eight ball and then get the virus? So it's been overstated that, for instance, vitamin D cures this problem. That's not the case. But the supplements play a helpful role, and so we do position them up front in the protocol.
Now, doctor, I also believe ivermectin has been proven efficacious, and it certainly is in people that I know and in their response. And I've heard hedging in the voices of the medical establishment about ivermectin, not about hydroxychloroquine, but about ivermectin. What do you think is the current status? And Dr. Collins told me there's a large trial underway now. Do you expect ivermectin will be shown to have been effective and tragically overlooked early?
Yeah, well, why were you denied ivermectin?
I was prescribed ivermectin. I believe that the medical community did not advertise it widely. My doctor immediately gave it to me when I was exposed.
Okay. Well, you know, ivermectin is accepted as a treatment. It's an antiparasitic drug that we use for scabies. It's safe and effective. And it went through clinical trials outside the United States, smaller trials, and they weren't, each individual trial wasn't sufficiently large, but there really haven't been any large mega trials. In my field, cardiology, when we do a large trial, we're talking 20,000 patients in a cholesterol pill trial. There hasn't been any study like that in COVID-19, despite having millions of cases. So for some reason, Dr. Collins and the National Institutes of Health, they don't seem to have any appetite for large treatment trials at all. But ivermectin is already accepted as effective, safe, and reduces the risk of hospitalization and death. And it works inside the hospital and outside the hospital. So large countries have ivermectin-based programs. In Mexico City was getting slammed with COVID. They adopted a full ivermectin program. They basically cleared out the city of COVID. They've done the same thing now in India. India got way behind, and they got a huge push on early treatment. They handed out ivermectin to everybody in major states like Goa and other places in India and handled it. And so in the United States today, we have two major treatment organizations or physician groups that support early treatment, FLCCC, which is an ivermectin-based group, and then the AAPS, Association of American Physician Surgeons. That's the one that's adopted the protocols that I've written. And protocols that I've written, give lots of options to doctors. And there's many ways to treat this illness. There can be hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin-based approaches. Believe it or not, in places where ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine have become so politicized, doctors have figured out how to treat patients with COVID-19 without these drugs. They treat the later part of the syndrome. Yeah.
It's interesting to me, doctor. I disagree with you as a layman on the hydroxychloroquine findings that I see available. And I've got a PhD toxicologist for a brother, and we go over all this stuff, and he spends as much time as possible with me trying to explain it to a lawyer. But I do want to go to the controversial aspects of your interview where I came up short and said, I got to follow up on that. In your Salem Now interview, and it's available for everyone, they should listen to it for free, by the way. We made it available for free because I don't think you've been given the platforms that you deserve, though we separate on some issues. And I'm paraphrasing. I was taking notes as I listened. I think you say something like, we have never advertised for a product before it was available before, referencing the vaccines. It seems like a playbook to suppress any hope of treatment and prepare the population for mass vaccination. Now, a playbook would imply a coach, someone to draft it. And so who are you suggesting came up with the playbook to push vaccines to the exclusion of medical treatment and to the gross underuse, as you say, of monoclonal antibodies?
Well, I think it's important for the listeners to understand when there's a dispute, someone says, well, I don't think hydroxychloroquine works. Well, I don't think it works either, because no drug works in COVID-19 alone. Doctors don't treat fatal viral infections by using one drug. We always use drugs in combination. So it's a fool's errand to argue if hydroxychloroquine works or ivermectin works. We use drugs in combination. So it's very, very important. We look for signals of benefit and acceptable safety, and we put drugs in combination just like we do with HIV. So that's really important. So any time that, like, for instance, you say, well, doctor, I disagree with you about hydroxychloroquine. Okay, I said, okay, well, do you disagree with the other 4 to 6 drugs we use? And you say, well, of course not. Well, so we have to, I think, take a much more reasonable approach to discussing medicines for COVID-19, because we all want to prevent hospitalization and death. And as you mentioned, the early emergency use authorization for the monoclonal antibodies are wonderful. We now have the Regeneron antibody. GlaxoSmithKline just had one for early inpatient treatment. They have the same approval level as the vaccines. And what my patients ask me is, doctor, how come I don't see anything about these monoclonal antibodies on TV? When I get my COVID-19 result, I don't have any information on how to access them. There's no 1-800 numbers. There seems to be no public health interest in helping people get a monoclonal antibody infusion, but there seems to be overwhelming zeal for promoting vaccination. So we've heard morning, noon, and night.
Doctor, for your benefit, whenever I say something like that, it's not to argue with you. It's because my audience has been listening to me for 20 years, and they've heard me say I'm not persuaded about hydroxychloroquine. And if I don't alert you to that, they often are confused that I'm not giving you the background. So I don't want to debate with you. You're a medical expert. I'm a lawyer. I'm just asking questions, but I like my audience to know I'm being thoroughly honest with you when I tell people I'm skeptical of hydroxychloroquine based upon my lawyer's reading and my conversations. It's not to argue with you. It's just to point out that that's my conclusion. You have a different conclusion. But I go back to the question I posed.
I disagree. We actually have the same conclusion. And I think it's important. Lawyers are good listeners. An important conclusion: no single drug works alone. There's no single cure, but the drugs work in combination. That's the reason why we don't agree. We actually agree. Hydroxychloroquine, like other drugs, they don't work alone, but they work in combination. All we're looking for is a little edge, a signal of benefit. And we have, with hydroxychloroquine, it's been the most studied and the most widely relied upon drug for treating COVID-19 in the world. There's a reason why. I mean, it's standard outside the United States in vast regions because it works in combination with other drugs.
Oh, I'd be open to any evidence. And I do count myself as a pretty good listener, doctor. But I listened closely to your answer, and it didn't include the answer to my first question, which is, where did the playbook come from that you referenced that pushed vaccination to the exclusion of things such as monoclonal antibodies? Who developed the playbook?
Well, it would have to be the groups that organize the public health communications. So, the communications playbook is important. Americans get their information through the media. And so if they're getting no information about the monoclonal antibodies, which are emergency use authorized, I mean, are you getting those? Are you getting the messages 3 times a day? If you get sick with COVID, here's how you get an antibody infusion.
No, but I don't dispute that. I'm asking you, who do you think came up with the playbook that you assert exists? Because a playbook implies a coach, is like intelligent design implies a designer, a watch implies a watchmaker. Who came up with the playbook? Is it NIH, CDC, FDA? And if so, is it the top rungs?
Well, there's a communication plan. So you just agreed that you don't hear anything about the monoclonal antibodies. And they have emergency use authorization just as equal as the vaccine. So So you haven't heard anything about these. So the next patient in your area, your listener, your listening area, who gets acutely sick with COVID-19, some of them may not have even heard about these life-saving therapies. If you can think about that, that is an egregious blunder, if you will, on executing a playbook on crisis communication. So the crisis communication playbook, there are our agencies, our National Institutes of Health, the FDA, and the NIH. They have budgets. There are public service announcements. There's internet announcements. And those same agencies, the groups that are doing the public service advertisements and messages for the vaccine, those same groups are also responsible for the monoclonal antibodies. They're under the emergency use authorization. They are not pharmaceutical products for sale. They can't. Pharmaceutical companies can't advertise this. If you notice, you don't see any Regeneron ad for monoclonal antibodies. They can't sell them directly to the public because they're not fully FDA approved. So our public health agencies do have powers, in a sense, to execute a playbook. Our National Institutes of Health, for instance, did have a tremendous amount of freedom in terms of their decisions on how to execute treatment. And I've told you, they have not executed a single large-scale clinical trial in outpatients with COVID-19. None.
I heard you say that.
They didn't even try.
And by the way, it's an interview, not a debate. I don't disagree with anything you're saying. I just want to make sure. You are the malfeasance you discuss at length in the Salem Now interview. You are attributing to the CDC, the NIH, and the FDA. And that's who you accuse of malfeasance. Do you accuse the president's task force of malfeasance, President Trump and now President Biden?
Well, President Trump and President Biden, I think Americans could just ask the question, have they ever seen either one of those leaders indicate that COVID-19 hospitalization and death are a serious problem and that they're going to rely on doctors who have learned how to treat this problem to help America get out of this crisis? Neither one of them could ever frame the problem of hospitalization and death being serious consequences and have an understanding that we have to do something before the hospital to prevent the hospitalization. That seems to be fundamental. No one in the White House task force could say that. No one in the FDA, CDC, or NIH could say that. And if no one can frame the problem, that would make sense now. If you can't frame the problem, why would they ever even try research before the hospital? And that's probably the reason why the NIH never did research. The NIH should have a portfolio of completed clinical trials, and they should know exactly what drug cocktails people should do at home to prevent hospitalization and death, and they don't.
So I asked that question to demonstrate what I consider to be the case, that you are bipartisan in your critique. You are not a partisan. You are a scientist. Now I want to go to the most controversial thing I heard in your interview. Quote, this is about marking people, behavior control. The establishment wants needles in the arm. Why? Now, when I hear that, doctor, I think to myself, fundamentalists will hear that out there and say he's talking about mark of the beast stuff. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, marking is a concept that literally has come into American life in the last 4 months. We started out with this vaccine program. It was completely elective, completely elective. And you could do it if you wanted to. If you didn't, the consent form says that these are investigational. We don't know if they're going to work. There's only 2 months of data. We don't know what the side effects are. The consent form says it could be as little as a sore arm or you could die with it. That's what the consent form says. Completely elective. Everything on the CDC website says it's completely elective. And within 4 months now, Hugh, we've got people losing their jobs. We've got people trying to approve whether or not they've had the shot or not. There are considerations for vaccine passport programs, kids' college-educated careers on the line. That's pretty extraordinary. So this mark of being vaccinated now is a very important sociological feature. Wouldn't you
agree? Doctor, though, are you making the argument that some fundamentalists would make? I am not a fundamentalist. I'm a Roman Catholic. I don't even read Revelations. But do you believe this is an effort by the government to mark people?
It's an effort by stakeholders in the vaccine program, and that would be Pfizer, Moderna, J&J, AstraZeneca, and the other companies that are linked together through the vaccine consortiums. the CDC, the NIH, and the FDA. It is an effort from those stakeholders to be certain that there's a needle in every arm. And because the push is so strong, even in groups that don't really get COVID or serious COVID, so for instance, children, the stakeholders have expressed an interest in vaccinating children who this problem doesn't affect them. They have an interest in vaccinating people who have already recovered from COVID, where you can't get it a second time. So it's led Americans to wonder, what is it about this vaccine? Is it really all about COVID? Or does it have to do with some form of marking or some type of acceptance of something that's thrust upon a body? And then from that point forward, one has some type of credential. They can get a passport or they can apply to school or what have you. The marking is what's really disturbing Americans right now. It should be just purely elective.
So, but doctor, I want to go back. In your interview, you say you are the most courageous doctor in the United States, given the stance that you've taken and given the position of authority that you hold, you can successfully hold that. Can we be blunt, though? Is there a religious aspect to this marking? Are you suggesting it is, as some fundamentalists believe, and I'm not a fundamentalist and I'm not a theologian, but do you believe it's part of that mark in Revelation?
Well, yeah, your views on the religion, wouldn't matter for this interview, and neither would mine. But some may consider that marking means something other than COVID. The disturbing thing, though, is that if the vaccine stakeholders want a needle in every arm, including people who can have zero benefit from the vaccine, and the vaccine is investigational and it's completely elective, but they have an interest. They have an interest in vaccinating people who can't benefit, the issue of marking comes up.
But doctor, do you your religious beliefs do matter because it figures into the context from which your opinions derive. Are you saying that you fear personally that this is a mark of the beast program?
My personal views on the vaccine are, those are personal, private decisions, just like yours are. And they have a special place in each person's overall sphere of physical and personal and spiritual health. And it's really important for everybody to understand there is the principle of autonomy. Very important. The principle of autonomy is that each individual gets to decide what gets injected into their body. Okay. And they can take advice. They can consider whatever it means to them. And, and this includes getting a tattoo. Someone may want to get marked with a tattoo. Someone may not want to get marked with a tattoo. But they decide, free of any pressure, coercion, or threat of reprisal, free of is really, really important. There are vaccine lotteries out there where if people will actually sign up for the vaccine, they can get into a lottery to win $1 million. We've never seen this level of coercion before. There are states that are adopting laws that say that the children age 12 can make their own decision on a vaccine without parental consent. And they'll be in a coercive environment in the school where other children may be getting the vaccine so they can undergo, play sports or what have you. These are unprecedented times, and it's making some people concerned that
I understand that. And people can listen to the entire Salem Now, and you expand on that at length. But the question that was not answered is religious beliefs do play heavily in the minds of the audience as to credibility. I am not a fundamentalist. I don't believe that it's a mark of the beast. I tend to attribute good faith to people, but I want people to understand where you are coming from and where some people who object to the vaccine are coming from, however few or many they might be. So your religious belief actually does matter to the credibility of your point of view and not stating it. I'm just, I've done 25,000 interviews in my life from presidents and prime ministers to doctors and scientists. If you don't answer the question, people tend to not take the credibility that you deserve, given your scientific background, as seriously. But they do want to know theologically if you are a fundamentalist who are concerned with a revelations-related issue. Are you?
Your questions are ones that I think have to be framed in a way, especially in an interview like this, where it's not set up to be a theologic discussion. Each one of us has our spirituality. And then we're largely born into our religion. Okay. And I wasn't born into a Muslim family or a Hindu family. And so I didn't have a chance to, in a sense, have that framework to interpret my spirituality. But my spiritual, religious, and closely held beliefs regarding my personal health, which are largely conventional. I'm very pro-vaccine. I've taken all the vaccines I'm supposed to take. I've had two vaccines this year already. Those are private pieces of information, and I think we ought to move on. My credibility as a doctor, I'm in my fourth decade of doing this, and I have over 600 peer-reviewed publications in the medical literature, 40 papers on COVID-19. I dropped everything for COVID-19. I've analyzed more data. I've shared more data safety monitoring boards for high-stakes drugs trials and device trials than anybody in the field. And not only that, but I've seen and treated and examined patients with COVID-19. You haven't talked to a person on your show with those credentials.
Doctor, I'm not arguing with that. I mean, I've talked to Dr. Fauci and Dr. Collins, and I've talked to other critics of them, and I've talked to everyone. But as a lawyer, if you were on the stand, I'm rejoining the program now. If you're on the stand, I would then say to you that, okay, that's all very well and good, but we're having a trial here, and I need to know for the benefit of the fact finders what motivation you might have, and your religious beliefs would enter into it. Now, you declined to answer. I understand completely, but I really would like to know if you are like a Baptist, a Catholic, a fundamentalist, an evangelical, a non-literalist. I think it would frame the context in which you speak, not your scientific chops, which are extraordinary, which is why I'm hosting you and why Salem Now has your interview up. They are simply unparalleled, and I defer to that. I'm not arguing about that. I'm arguing about how context always impacts political discussions, and your condemnation of the NIH, CDC, and FDA is a political statement as well as a medical one. So I have two more questions ago, so I just wanted to ask you, are you in fact a fundamentalist?
You know, that was a really long question. If we were in trial, you'd be saying, "Oh my gosh, this witness is really, you know, manhandling me." And sometimes that happens to lawyers. But I attend Methodist Church, and you said that, you know, it's unparalleled, and it's true. You have interviewed Fauci and Collins. They have not seen and examined a single person with COVID-19. They wouldn't know what one looks like. In fact, you should probably check to see if they are actually board certified in their fields or carry medical licenses. I can tell you that they have not invested in any research to help Americans prevent hospitalization and death. Zero. It was very early in the pandemic. There must have been a decision that we were going to play defense, that we were going to allow as many hospitalizations and deaths that were going to occur, let them occur, and put a chill on early treatment through regulatory statements, and then wait for mass vaccination. And that's what's happened.
And Dr. Might, so you know my point of view is I think so many mistakes were made, especially in the CDC testing and in their Zavagna long ago persuaded me that we were not doing treatment at home like we should have been. I don't disagree with a lot of your diagnosis of what went wrong. I do disagree that there's a theological aspect to it. I do disagree that there's an ill motive. I just think everyone's screwed up because of the asymptomatic transmission aspect and that we would do it very differently. I do want to close with another controversial thing you said, since I'm not going to get you to tell me whether or not you think it's the mark of the beast, obviously. Lawyers know when a witness isn't going to answer, and I haven't got a judge to direct the witness to answer, nor do I want to. It's not hostile. I like a lot of what you have to say, and I don't have your credibility, and very few people do. But you did say that there are 4,000 dead Americans who die on days 1, 2, and 3 after the vaccine. Now, I do not believe I've read anything like that. And however, correlation is not causation. I'm sure that out of the 167 million people that have been vaccinated, 4,000 have died. Are you saying that 4,000 Americans died because of the vaccine?
Yeah, well, I want to be clear, since you've really made such a focus on this, that I don't think there's a religious connotation to what's going on either. And I think it's probably appropriate to put so much time on it. But Americans are told through the investigational use application, go to vaers.com. Go to the website and look at the safety data. And so are you. You're told to do that. And so you said, I haven't seen 4,000 deaths. I haven't seen it. You may not have gone to the website. And a lot of my patients are attorneys, as you can imagine. I tell you, they do. And right now I'm looking at the data, and I'll read it to your readers, that these are confirmed by the CDC. The events initially get a temporary ID until they vet it and make sure it really happened. This is what they have. Deaths. This is after COVID vaccinations, J&J, Moderna, and Pfizer in the U.S., 4,406 deaths, 14,986 hospitalizations, 34,474 urgent care visits, 45,006 office visits, 1,214 cases of anaphylaxis, severe allergic reaction, and 1,411 cases of Bell's palsy where the face is paralyzed on one side. Now, I can tell you that entire scoreboard for, let's say, for mortality per year, for all the vaccines combined in the United States per year that get reported in, are about 200 per year. So at this level, this program exceeds all deaths reported in relationship to any vaccine for 30 years. You ask the question, well, is it due to the vaccine? The only way to find out if it's due to the vaccine is to have an external, unbiased clinical event committee, like we do in large drug and device clinical trials, and then have a data safety monitoring board. Those two bodies are very important, very important. The stakeholders who have an interest in vaccination, they can't actually determine whether or not whether or not it happened in relationship to the vaccine. So right now, all we know is temporal relationship. We know that 40% of these deaths occur on days 1, 2, and 3, and the envelope, the time window of envelope, is about 30 days. And we have a general understanding that these are not current, that these are running way behind in terms of entries, so it's so laborious to enter these. So it's 4,400, but there may be a 1 or 2 month lag. If you can imagine, if we add in March, April, and May statistics, how these numbers are going to climb. By any stretch of the imagination, these numbers are alarming. They're through the roof.
Actually, Doctor, I'm not alarmed, but I would like to know if you believe, if Dr. Peter McCullough believes that many, if not most of the 4,000 who die after days 1, 2, and 3 after the vaccine are because of the vaccine. Proximate cause, that's the law, language of the law. Is the vaccine causing these people to die? Because I have seen no one make that statement, none. And I got to push on it because it's the key statement. Do you believe that?
Well, I told you, in order for us to believe that, we'd need an independent clinical event adjudication committee. We'd need a data safety monitoring committee, and we'd actually have to review the records. You as an attorney would know that we'd actually have to review the records in each case. We have to see the laboratories, what happened, when they came into the hospital, or if they died at home. That would have to be evaluated. All we have right now is temporal relationship. 40% occur on days 1, 2, and 3. So there's a big spike in the deaths right after the vaccine, and then it comes down to an ambient level.
So you don't know. You're not willing to say that you believe X number of the 4,000 are related to the vaccine because we don't have those bodies, we don't have those investigations, so you don't know if those 4,000 deaths are related to the vaccine. Do I understand you correctly?
Well, we don't have the transparency to know. All we know is that it's an extremely large number, and we know for other vaccines, for instance, there are many hundreds of millions of administrations because of the flu vaccine every year. It's 195 million. Shingles and all the childhood vaccinations, the meningococcal vaccinations. So we know the denominator. If there's 200 deaths with the other vaccines that are considered safe, and that denominator is way bigger than how many people have received COVID, and we have 4,406 with COVID that the CDC has said is a solid number, we have a concerning number, and they just didn't fall out of the sky.
Well, I get that. I'm just asking, given your background and your authority and your learning, whether you think a majority or even most of those 4,000 or a significant number of those 4,000 were caused by the vaccination in any of its form, J&J, Moderna, Pfizer, the three that are approved in the United States. Do you, Dr. McCullough, believe that?
But we need, in order to believe something scientifically, we have to see the proper science being done. and the proper transparency of data. These are deaths. These are Americans who have died. Families have questions on this. So you're asking if I can believe it. Well, you know, the agencies have to come clean on this. There needs to be transparency. They just can't put up on a scoreboard that is 4406, and well, there you go.
No, but Doctor, what I'm saying, I believe everyone should get vaccinated, and that it's very important for the purposes of the world and the country and people's individual safety. You do not believe that, but you don't have data on which to base that. And I've got the recommendations of the FDA, the CDC, the NIH, and the other doctors that I've talked to. So you're the outlier when it comes to that opinion. So I want to give you the opportunity to tell people, why do you think the vaccine, just because there are more cases recorded, to which I would respond, maybe we're studying this more closely.
Well, we know that over 80% are reported by doctors and other healthcare workers. And we know the CDC has a pretty rigorous process before they go ahead and log one of these. And we do know that just for this class of vaccines, you know, it's extraordinary. It's 20 times that of all the vaccines combined per year. So I think we all agree it's a large number. Now, this idea of we should all get vaccinated or not all get vaccinated, I've always taken the view that for every vaccine, it should be narrowly applied for the maximum benefit. So, for instance, you know, we don't blanket the children with, you know, all the vaccines at once. You know, it's pneumococcal vaccine for the right group in the elderly. It's the meningococcal vaccine when the kids go to school. It's the childhood vaccines. And there's 70 of them. And I've had them all. I use them all in practice. I'm very a pro-vaccine. But this one's very unusual. This vaccine, this class of vaccines, for the first time use new technology where they trick the body into making the Wuhan spike protein. That's the protein on the surface of the virus that was developed through the gain-of-function research in the Wuhan virology lab. There's a furin cleavage joint that's now unbreakable. Your body used to be able to break that with a natural enzyme called furin. So that's what caused the virus to be so infectious and so dangerous. You know, common cold doesn't kill you, but COVID-19 can. And so this spike protein is concerning. And what we were told originally is it just stays in the arm and it doesn't circulate. Now we know in the last 2 weeks that indeed it circulates for sure.
So Doctor, we're almost out of time. So I want to give one last question to you. And I appreciate so much of your time this morning. And I want people to listen to your entire 2-hour conversation. Do you believe you'll have moral agency, moral culpability if someone declines to get the vaccine and they subsequently die of COVID because of your conversations and your advice? Do you believe that will be on you as a moral actor?
Well, I give advice in the fiduciary relationship between doctor and patient, right? So I manage my patients. About 70% of my patients have received the vaccine in December, January, and February. And based on the outpouring of safety data, I no longer generally recommend the vaccine. I think the vaccine program is essentially over with at this point.
Doctor, I got to break it. You just said there isn't any safety data, that we don't know about these 4,000. So what safety data are you, the J&J 8?
Well, no, I've read the safety data to you. So I've read it to you. So I said there's safety data, and I've read it to you on the show. You asked the question about moral agency, and I said that's really restricted to the doctor-patient relationship. The CDC and the FDA and the NIH, they're public servants. They serve us. They serve the patient and the doctor. They interpret data and give advice and warning, but they don't see and examine patients. They're not responsible for patients. They don't have any malpractice or any responsibility of what happens to an individual patient. They're responsible for providing a support service to us now. So the moral agency question of when people interpret information, people have a fair opportunity to hear different points of view. I'm telling you the data that I read to you from the database, my interpretation is those numbers are very large. They're much larger than they are for other accepted safe vaccines, and they're concerning.
So I get that's your interpretation. My question was, given your interpretation will influence people, And that is simply the way that human beings work. We take in information, we process it, we attribute it to the person who's speaking, and we take it in the context of their credentials. And yours are large, and yours are extraordinary, and you have published 40 papers on this subject. And while you are an outlier, you are nevertheless a significant outlier by your own admission in the longer interview. If you influence people to get not to get the vaccine, if you do that, and I can, they write out, I did not get the vaccine because of Dr. Peter McCullough's conversations on Salem Now with Hugh Hewitt, and that person dies, and the family believes they died because they didn't get the vaccine, what would your answer be in court in your reply? If you've led them to believe it's dangerous and they didn't get the vaccine and they died, are you responsible?
Well, there's large groups that don't agree with mass vaccination of the entire population. Large groups, groups in the United States, Canada, worldwide, many tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of signatories on these. There's a demand letter into WHO right now with tens of thousands of signatures from prominent doctors asking for transparency on vaccine safety. So when it's important for your listeners to understand, they have a less than 1% chance of ever coming in contact with COVID. It's a less than 1% chance. That's what we saw in the vaccine trials. You're someone who took the vaccine. You have less than a 1% chance of getting COVID. In fact, you already told the listeners you had COVID.
So no, I didn't. I did not. I said I was exposed to it and I got ivermectin. I did not have COVID.
Okay. So to be fair, though, even if you have not had COVID, the people who have gotten a vaccine have less than a 1% chance of ever coming in contact with COVID. And if they come in contact with COVID, we know the vaccine doesn't prevent all the cases. The CDC already had 10,000 cases of fully vaccinated people who developed full-blown COVID. 9% were hospitalized, 3% died. So we know the vaccine doesn't prevent COVID 100%. Those numbers are probably grossly underreported because they had to use phone systems to try to ascertain if they were previously vaccinated. So no, individuals have to make their own choice. This is the principle of autonomy. The moral agency on this is an investigational vaccine. It doesn't work all the time. It has large safety numbers that are accruing in a CDC database that's causing alarm. There are demand letters into agencies asking for transparency. I've told you, I am asking the agencies for transparency.
And so, Doctor, let's conclude. I appreciate your time. I don't think it's persuasive because you've been evasive in some direct questions of the sort that lawyers typically insist on. But you are persuasive as to your critiques of the early response. I just wanted to give you the final word. That's my conclusion, is that I would not take your advice on vaccine because you're not forthright in responding to direct questions about the most important issues to me as a lawyer and as a listener. But you are persuasive in your critiques of the NIH, FDA, and CDC's early responses and about getting treatment early at home. You have the last word, Doctor.
Well, I'm not trying to be persuasive. Each individual has to make their own decision. As someone who's taken the vaccine, I think you already have a stake in this. You want to believe that it works. You want to believe that it's safe. So your lens on your eyes, you can't be a fair evaluator of this situation because you're already a stakeholder.
I'm not evaluating the vaccine. I'm evaluating your responsiveness and credibility as someone who's speaking on it.
And your position of evaluating my response can't be unbiased because you've already decided to take the vaccine.
That's not how the law works, doctor. That's wrong. Yeah, that's simply wrong.
Yeah, but you have already taken the vaccine.
Yep. But that doesn't go to the evaluator or the trier of fact. That's simply wrong.
So the issue is not for you, right? You've already had it.
No, doctor, that's just completely wrong. The trier of fact, the fact that they've had the vaccine, it doesn't go to your persuasiveness in answering direct questions on the air. That's just simply irrelevant to that. And you might not get that, but as a lawyer, I wouldn't expect you to get what lawyers say, but that's simply irrelevant to your persuasiveness to someone who's had the vaccine or not had the vaccine when you don't answer direct questions.
You would agree that if you've already had the vaccine, you don't have to be persuaded to get the vaccine.
That's
you
correct.
You agree with that as a lawyer.
But that doesn't go to your answers on whether...
Now that we have that established, you don't have to agree. So I'm going to say, listen, this is a court of law. You're losing here. The bottom line is,
you think
for
that
individuals who
you
are
better never go to law.
For individuals who haven't had the vaccine, those are the ones who are wondering. They're the ones who are trying to decide. And there's fewer of them. We have more than half of America that have been vaccinated.
And that's why I invited you on. But if they decide not to get vaccinated because of you, I think you will have moral agency. And I didn't hear you accept that clearly.
If someone gets the vaccine or they don't get the vaccine and they get COVID, they're treated the same way anyway. I'm the one who brought America and the world the treatment protocols that reduce hospitalization and death by 85%. Patients, and I've had patients who've been fully vaccinated and they get COVID anyway. So the care and compassion and the fiduciary relationship is there anyway. The decision for someone to get the vaccine or not is their own decision. That's the principle of autonomy. There's no carriage of moral agency. In fact, the concern would be the carriage of moral agency if someone is coaxed into this because of a $1 million raffle and they die of the vaccine that night because of a severe reaction. The moral agency could be carried by those who coerce.
Oh, that's absolutely true. That's a legal argument. That's absolutely true. If someone bought a lotto ticket and got the vaccine because of it and it killed them, but there is no evidence that that's occurred. In fact, the only evidence I've seen that is scientifically adduced is that the Johnson & Johnson had, what, 8 incidents, 3 of which were fatal, and that it's so rare that they ought not to have paused the J&J. So, but you're right as to moral agency. That you're absolutely right. But I think the same moral agency standard applies to you. And that's why I don't give advice. I'm not a doctor. I just wanted to let you know that some of your non-responsiveness goes to credibility in the idea in the ears of the audience. And in my ear, it's not particularly, well, it's not at all persuasive because you weren't forthright.
Well, I'm just, I read you the data. That's as forthright as it can be. You said you've never heard of it. So I read you the data. I looked right at it. That is as forthright and transparent as I can.
No, there is no data saying causation. There's no data. There are 4,000 deaths on day 1, 2, and 3, but there's no data saying that those deaths are the result of the vaccine.
Because that evaluation hasn't been done.
Correct. I get that. I get that. But you were putting words in my mouth, and I just don't want that to happen. I heard you. I understand what you said. I listened to your tape, but I didn't say what you said. I said, so, doctor, I don't want to end hostile. I just want to end with thanking you for coming on, but pointing out for my audience's benefit that the non-responsiveness to direct questions and occasionally deflecting deters from credibility. And I don't know that you're aware of that particularly, but it does have that impact. Last word to you, doctor, and then I have to go.
Well, I've been direct with your listeners, and that's the most important thing. It's not what you think, it's what your listeners think. I've been very direct with them. I've read them the data. I've told them that our agencies have not done an investigation in causality, so no one knows. But these deaths and hospitalizations come in close time frame from what people get the vaccines. And the people who lost family members and the people who have had family members hospitalized, been hospitalized themselves, they are wondering whether it was due to the vaccine or not. And our agencies have that moral responsibility to do that evaluation.
Doctor, I agree with that. I think the evaluation should be done, and I hope you'll come back. I want everyone to listen to the longer interview at salemnow.com and this, which I'll post at the podcast. I appreciate your time, Dr. McCullough, and all the effort that you have put into curing the ill and the personal risk you've taken in doing so. And I think your accomplishments are extraordinary and significant, though we disagree on some things. And the interview is a little rocky at points. I really do appreciate your candor and your coming on.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. That concludes today's episode of The Interview with Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for listening. Make sure you come back and check out all the other podcasts on the Salem Podcast Network. And remember to thank our sponsors, AndrewandTodd.com. If you believe in long-form interviews like I do, then do your real estate transactions with Andrew Del Rey and Todd Avakian. I've known both men for a long time. AndrewandTodd.com. Go there, answer a couple of questions. They'll tell you what's best to do with your house or call them at 888-888-1172. You'll be glad you did, and you'll be glad that you listened to the next episode of The Interview.